You will now hear Sue Malvern and then Sunil Gupta. Sue?
Can you hear me? Yeah. If you put up my slides, I'll kind of come to them, and we don't have to wait for them to appear. I'm going to talk here about the relationship between museums and memorials. In particular, I'm very interested, as Christine and Vera have already raised, the ways in which memorials and museums script spaces for viewers to perform trauma. I'm going to particularly raise a memorial in Olav, but I'm arguing is kind of all very closely implicated with the museum. And I'm also going to produce right at the end an example of an outdoor exhibition that took place there around this memorial, an artist's intervention, at the height of outrage about an Austrian agony about the election of a member of the Freedom Party to government there, something which has a lamentable resonance now in the light of events in France. This exhibition in Love with an intervention in public space, an expansion of museum practices that would, I hope, have intrigued Judith enormously. My slides still haven't appeared, but I'm sure they will. It might be stating the obvious if I begin by saying that museums are closely implicated with memorials and monuments, both functioning as mnemonic devices that regulate public memory. Many museums were established as memorials to their founders. Donald Preziosi describes the museum as always everywhere, teleological machines and landscapes of geomancy. That is, storehouses for objects ritually ordered so as to guarantee, what he writes, the preservation of the spirit of the departed or absent person. When we approach the museum, when we approach the memorial, we know that we must approach it with reverence and decorum appropriate to conducting acts of remembrance and contemplation. Death is a very common metaphor in critical discussions of museums. Adorno described museums pessimistically as mausoleums containing objects in the process of dying. Lacking a vital relationship to the viewer, museum objects testified, he wrote, to the neutralization of culture. The critical project then becomes how to reinsert the living into the museum as grave or mausoleum. Note too the extent to which museums, particularly those dedicated to recording or narrating traumatic events such as war or the Holocaust, also contain halls of remembrance. These often occupy spaces at the conclusion of the visit so that the visitor may recollect and memorize the lessons of the display spaces which they have just traversed. And for example, on your right is the Hall of Remembrance in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. And Kreisler and Kuznow, when they wrote in our journal in 1997, described the ordering of the displays of the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington as one in which the visitor is first recruited as witness, then identified as victim, or if you like, traumatized, who is then reborn and assimilated in the Hall of Remembrance as the subject of a tolerant state. When the Imperial War Museum, which is the slide on the other side, was founded in 1917 in London, it opened in 1920, it contained a cenotaph court, and guns were sometimes draped with wreaths. So what you've got there is some of their guns, and behind it a proportion of Lutyens' cenotaph from Whitehall, the original plaster structure, which was then made permanent in 1920. And the guns appeared to lose their militaristic and destructive connotations to become like religious emblems. Interestingly, this also, and this may be a reason why some of these things I'm raising are quite problematic. It also contained a women's war shrine in 1920, virtually the only kind of commemoration of women at all in the First World War. So the whole museum was conceived as a kind of, not as a museum, but as a shrine, which was a place for pilgrimage. And my next example is then, wrong way. The opening space of the Jewish Museum in Vienna is also a Hall of Remembrance, which you see a fragment of here, which also contains the work by Nancy Sparrow called Remembrance Renewal. One of the first art galleries, John Soane's Dulwich Picture Gallery, which is usually taken as a paradigm for all the art galleries we built, also contains a mausoleum to the collectors who assembled its first collections. The gallery and the mausoleum then function as domains of reverie and imagination for both death and art. And Stirling's Claw Gallery extension at the Tate Millbank to house the Turner Collection takes the form of a garden mausoleum. In the same vein, when the Tate or Millbank, now called, renamed Tate Britain, we reopened in last October after extensive refurbishment, its new entrance on Manton Street, which you can see on your right, and there's more of the facade on the left, has very carefully, they spent millions on this, it's very carefully preserved the shrapnel damage from 1942, when the gallery was strafed by a stray German bomber during the Blitz, presumably in order to emphasise and commemorate the building's own trauma. Sorry, that the idea that the museum itself is a wounded museum. And you can see the kind of damaged bits and pieces. So they haven't restored it when they remade the museum this last year. I've been talking about how much museums are implicated in memorials, but I also want to note the escalation of new museums dedicated to trauma, especially the Holocaust, alongside a great increase in the production of memorials, which are also usually dedicated to the Holocaust. For example, the Imperial War Museum in London opened a new Holocaust section in 2000, which mimics in style, content and narrative, though not in size, Washington's Holocaust Memorial Museum. That's the Imperial War Museum, and on the other side is Washington's. In fact, Lisa just showed you that section from Washington's museum. So this is London, that's Washington. You could also consider that the Imperial War Museum's next project after the completion of its Holocaust section is a genocide section. There's a sort of sense in which there's no boundaries now about what museums may or may not do. The genocide section will conclude the displays. It'll be the last area you arrive at. The Imperial War Museum's Holocaust section attracts a huge number of visitors, and there are some very difficult and important questions to ask about these new museums, which might represent what Mark Seltzer has called wound culture, or a public fascination with torn and open bodies and torn and open persons, what he calls a collective gathering around the shock, the trauma, and the wound. He terms it a pathological public sphere. I would term this a kind of trauma tourism. One thing that really interests me is the extent to which women artists are also being increasingly recruited to make memorials alongside these museums to these impossible subjects like the Holocaust. For example, Nancy Sparrow in Vienna's Jewish Museum, but also Rachel White-Reed in Judenplatz in Vienna, which I'll come to later. I want to talk about the peace memorial at Allauf in Austria as a way of raising some questions around gender and memory and the performance of trauma and the implications this has for how museums are scripted. Allauf is a two-part monument by, that's the whole monument seen from the distance, by Jenny Holzer, and a Russian artist called Oleg Komov. It was unveiled in 1995, and it commemorates the historic meeting and handshake of an American and a Russian general at midnight on the 8th of May 1945, the moment of the unconditional surrender of Hitler's Germany. That's the Holzer side. Holzer's contribution is well known because it's been quite often reproduced. Oleg's contribution is almost never reproduced. It was also planned before the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, quite deliberately, to be a two-part monument by an American and a Russian. Allauf is a small rural community of about 1,200 inhabitants near Melk in Lower Austria, and the significance of its site was unknown until an emigrant from the area who left to escape racism uncovered its history. And the monument itself is sited at a junction of a minor road off the main street. Holtz's contribution consists of a vertical laser light placed in the centre of a memorial garden. It projects... It projects 1 mile into the sky after the sunset, and its mechanism resembles a stele or a grave marker. It's approached by two pavements on which are inscribed short statements characteristic of Holtz's work. So you can see the pavements and the stele or the kind of laser light there. There are 37 in German and 36 in English, but there are differences between the two series. And the garden which surrounds it was designed by Maria Auerbach and is planted with white flowers and shrubs to symbolise pacifism and hope. The pathway in English leads to the back of the memorial, and the German path is directed towards Komhoff's work and crosses the traffic island between the two sites. So you're standing on Komhoff's area and looking at the Holzer when you're in that slide. Komhoff's contribution is an over life-size narrative sculpture. That's the pathway. So I'm kind of curtailing this, that's why we're rushing through slides. There we go. It's an over life-size narrative sculpture of two generalized American and Russian heroes, each of whom holds a bunch of flowers. And between them is a young girl dressed in Austrian national costume. She stands in between and touches them both. It's set on a conventional plinth. A sign on the traffic island in between, which you can't see at all, in German, English and Russian, describes what this memorial is about. But there's also a difference in the wording in the German and English texts. The English reads, "The classical idealist sculpture of Oleg Komhoff stands in opposition to the engraved plates on the ground by Jenny Holzer." I won't read the German, I'll read the translation. It repeats the sculpture of Oleg Komhoff stands in opposition to the engraved plates on the ground of The Horrors of War by Jenny Holzer. And I suggest this difference in wording is a starting point for confrontations and contestations that these two parts set up, and that these then bear on questions of gender and memory, which are very problematic for us. The liberation of Austria in April-May 1945 was comparatively rapid, but an account of the military events would mask the hysteria, displacement and disorder experienced in the collapse. Political prisoners, deserters and members of resistant groups were summarily tried and executed in the weeks of chaos. For example, 300 inmates of the prison at Stein were massacred on the 6th of April. At St. Pölten, 12 members of the resistance were shot 2 days before the city was liberated. As the Red Army drove east through Hungary, the SS emptied concentration camps and drove survivors west on forced marches. Numerous Hungarian Jews were murdered in the forests and meadows of the area around Allauf. The texts Holzer inscribes on her pavements refer to the disorder and chaos of defeat, cruel without hesitation, beraubte Juden, Jews robbed, and Wissensterben, dying from knowing. And these are a kind of... They become a metaphor for memories which lie beneath appearances and suggest that contemporary peacefulness at Allauf masks a terrible past in the horrors of war. Because it is low and flat, and because its one vertical element is the light, which is a dematerialized marker, Holzer's work is anti-monumental in form. It resembles the low horizontal wall of Mayer Lin's highly influential Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington. Like Mayer Lin's work, which is a self-effacing V-shaped scar cut beneath the surface of the gardens, which seems to embrace its visitors and invite them to touch the names embossed on its wall, Holzer's Allauf pavements also actively involve the spectators' physical participation in a walk. In order to see it, you have to walk along it slowly, traversing the garden and crossing the road towards Komhoff's figures while reading the text with head bowed. It's also perhaps worth noting how influential, how influential Lynn's memorial is for the establishment and form of the Washington Holocaust Memorial Museum, and that a tourist trip to the city nearly always includes a visit to both sites. And moreover, like the Washington Holocaust Museum, I'm arguing here that Holtz's text that allows also work like the script of a museum installation in which the viewer is first recruited as witness, then identified as victim, while the mile-high laser light symbolizing peace and hope, I suggest, enacts the viewer's rebirth after the pain and trauma of victimhood into the newly tolerant state. By contrast, the monumentality of Commonwealth war heroes and the humanitarian impulse suggested by the little girl, the only one of the three figures who gazes directly at the viewer, appears to suggest a conventional and direct encounter between the viewer and the authority of the memorial, and an ordinary narrative of peaceful meeting and resolution. Set on a plinth, everything is above ground, unlike the Holzer, and everything seems to be as it appears. Mayor Lynn's Vietnam memorial has been characterized as an antiphallic, feminine antithesis to the traditional war memorial. Its low V shape is read as a scar, as a wound, as a traumatic mark, if you like, even as a vagina. That's W.J.T. Mitchell, who argues that that's what it resembles. And it's said to be an ideal form for representing the trauma of a lost war. Lynn's memorial, then, has seen an answer to contemporary crisis about the forms of commemoration. At the same time, there's a widespread and powerful impulse to find permanent, indelible ways of marking traumatic events that pass out of living memory. The contemporary lack of confidence in war memorials and in old museums has complex roots. We could even say our lack of confidence in modernism has complex roots. I'm cutting a little bit, I will talk a bit more about why, but the point I also want to make is the appearance of minimalist art in the late 60s, which is now read as having refigured the nature of the sculptural encounter, has made traditional monuments seem even more impossible if there weren't other kinds of historical and political factors. Holtz's allowed pavements and the light act as a theatrical space, involving the viewer's physical bodily presence for its realization, and it also participates fully in the contemporary aesthetics of minimalism. It is possible to see Holtz's contribution to Erlauf as the orthodoxy and Komoff's conventional figures on the plinth as an aberration. If we take into account, however, that the Komoff and Holtzer elements at Erlauf have been set up in opposition to each other, then examining what is being opposed begins to make Holtz's contribution highly problematic. What seems to have been set up is a confrontation between a contemporary modern anti-monument from the Free West against a conventional socialist realist memorial from the enslaved East. Or put succinctly, feminine remembering is opposed to masculine commemoration. The point being that in current climate of opinion, it is feminine remembrance which carries authority because it is not authoritarian, and it is masculine commemoration which has been discredited because it speaks from a position of dominance. Susan Neuberg, in her essay about the unveiling, I'll do my best, says that Holtz's work can be deciphered as the work of a woman, and she talks about how Holtz turns to the victims, whereas Komoff depicts the heroes. She has a kind of, there is an implication then that she's essentialized Holtz's work. She then argues that there are no graves at the slab, so that there are no bodies actually present. But I argue that what she neglects is how the viewer's body is restored, a body is restored to the piece, the Holtzer, through the viewer's body, who assimilates and reads the text, as it were, into their own body in order to assimilate this trauma. In a way, we become the victim, or if not a victim, a grieved and pained figure, a feminized body. The result of the 1938 Anschluss and the 55 Declaration, which ended the occupation of the Russians and Americans, British and French, and founded the Austrian Republic. Austria has always cast itself as the first victim and martyr of Nazi aggression, and therefore been able to exonerate itself from complicity with Nazi war crimes. And I would, what I would rush through, I'm going to cut the... I'm just bringing you to the white reader. What Holzer does, whether unwittingly or not, is do nothing to unbind that. It fulfills this script that of Austria's sense of victimhood in relationship to 1938-45. And this was this kind of problem was one of the motivations for Shimon Wiesenthal's campaign for the Jewish memorial in Judenplatz, which has been made by Rachel Whiteread. But it's also worth noting that, subject to enormous delay, you see it here before its unveiling, the date of which the Jewish Museum was extremely coy about for because of the political situation in Austria at the time. It has now been unveiled. But it was, in the process of a very long delay, eventually expanded to include a museum which is behind the monument in the building you just see in the corner there, and where you now go into the museum and then beneath the monument in order to view the remains, archaeological remains of a synagogue, 15th century synagogue, which is located there. Come back to the exhibition at Erlauf and then we'll finish. In May to September 2000, just after Jörg Haider had appeared in the Austrian government, an exhibition was put together called Erlauf Erinnerung. Sorry about my badly spoken German. Erlauf Remembers. Six women were from Vienna, Munich, Belgrade, and the USA were invited to install temporary works of art in the village, including Adrian Piper. But the most interesting piece was a project by a young Belgrade artist called Malika Tomija. She installed 12 billboards either side of the main street, each with an enlarged photograph of a young man or a young woman who stands in the place of the little girl in Komov's statue. You can just see them, I think. The people were from Erlauf, aged 30 to 40, and from her own generation, meaning they were not old enough to have been present in 1945. And there was one additional billboard which showed the just outside the village, which was a photograph taken from the girl's position on Komov's figure group, which showed the view across the junction. What is very noticeable when one begins to reflect on it is that Komov's generalized, slightly modernized figures each wears a uniform emblematic of his or her nationality. Tomija herself is an Orthodox Christian Serbian who has made a number of works about questions of national identity that also explore the hysteria nationalism has given rise to in Serbia and her own very problematic relationship to the nationality as a Christian Serbian that she inherits. It includes the video, The Story of My Mother, which traces a journey she made daily across Belgrade to visit her mother during the NATO bombings. Tomija's work at Erlauf by positioning young adults in the place of the girl calls attention to a new generation's relationship to its past, and her work also revisions Komov's sculpture, remaking it and drawing attention to its relevance. Although Komov's heroes and little girl appear to be abstract types, they were based on studies he made of people like at Erlauf. And what I suggest that Tommy has done is bring the Komov to light and produce its relevance for her, to us in a way that I'd like to suggest Judith would have liked very much.
Thank you, Sue.